Okay. From Studio Live in Cumberland, BC, you're listening to the Edwell Valley Podcast.
Thanks for joining us again as we explore the food culture of the Comox Valley and the Vancouver Island and beyond.
I'm Chef Jonathan Fraser.
I'm Darren Howlett. And tonight we've got Brian Tyke sitting in with us. Brian, man about town, man of many talents. Right now I'm trying to think of how best to quantify. Brian's cooking career, food career, in hospitality over the years.
Not a bad fisherman.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
You might recognize him as one of the key people from the old Rockfish restaurant that everybody loved. You might recognize him as a bartender from many other places that had high-profile bars. You might recognize him from my old sushi cart. And where else would people have seen you? Right now, you're featured at Cornerstone, the new pub
in
town.
Yeah, I've kind of had a whirlwind of everywhere in the valley. So I've done spots at, you mentioned the Rockfish, your old nightclub, Saigon Noodle House for 11 years.
Saigon, you were there for years.
Where else?
One of the cooks there.
Yeah.
But that's just it. You sort of jump between, you're behind the, you know, your front end and back of house. It just depends on the job. You're either in the kitchen, behind the bar, or on the floor, just depending on what the job is. You're sort of a jack of all trades in that way.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really define myself as one position. Like, I mean, as a bartender, you have to know some culinary arts, and as a cook, you play with alcohol. So I think it's a very well-rounded area that I've been able to gain experience from in the valley alone and beyond. So
So that's just one aspect of you, and what brings you here tonight, or what we were hoping to talk with you more about tonight, actually stems from something completely different. This is not your sort of your career, your employment. This was more what you were pursuing as your academic studies.
Yeah. Yes.
That's where this all spun out of, which is, do you mind going into that a bit?
Yeah, for sure. So I stepped away from the food industry, at least I tried to, for 2.5 years when I went down to Nanaimo to finish off my degree. I started it up here at North Island College in criminology.
Right.
Before that, I did 2 years of business in marketing. And I finished the degree in criminology down at VIU. And during the end of the degree, I had to do a field placement, which I ended up doing at the Nanaimo Region John Howard Society.
Right.
So if people are not familiar with what John Howard Society does and who they deal with, generally it's post-release offenders provincially and federally, and anybody going to interact with the criminal justice system.
Right. So this is more or less, this is people that have been released or they've done their time or what have you, and this is to sort of, this is a program that eases them back into society.
Yeah, I mean, one of them. I mean, the John Howard Society all across Canada, they do so many different programs that can stem from storybook dads, which involves collecting storybooks, going to the prisons, having the fathers who are inmates read the stories and record it and then give it to their kids so that they can hear the voices of their own father.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
While they're in the prison system.
Yeah.
They also have like a Alzheimer's program. Restorative justice is a huge component, which are alternative justice measures for mostly first-time offenders and youth, but not exclusively.
Right.
And the program that I started working for right after my practicum, because I did my practicum in restorative justice, and then while I was there, they're like, well, we really want to keep you on, so the only position we have available is at a Vancouver Island therapeutic community, which is a not exclusively to ex-offenders, but it's also to mental health referrals, social programming, that kind of stuff, low income, subsidized housing. So basically what it is a subsidized therapeutic community where the residents of the house, all male, hold each other accountable during their recovery process. And what they originally hired me for was to be the in-house cook. So as much as I tried to escape the restaurant industry, it just never happened.
Pulled right back. Right?
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's born to be.
Once they know you're good with a frying pan, there's...
And, you know, it was hilarious because I never even showed my executive director my resume. I was just bringing in my own lunches. And apparently he was like, wow, that looks really good. He's like, did you order that? No, I cooked it. Okay, well, here's a job.
Yeah.
So...
which I can attest to. I mean, aside from menus that I've seen you perform, like, at various locations... the weekends where we were doing the food cart and you were like, let's not eat out of the cart. I'll make dinner or I'll make lunch. They were all absolutely fantastic. But
Thank you.
That's sort of deviating. But yeah, absolutely. I can see why he would be like, you must be good at what you do if that's what's for lunch. Yeah.
So when I stepped into that role, he kind of gave me three jobs. The first job he gave me was, okay, well, cook and look at the what's been ordered and maybe try your best to reduce costs. Mm-hmm. So when I started up there, they were spending upwards about $4,800 a month to feed 20 residents and the odd ex-resident, alumni, or staff that would come in and eat.
Right.
Now, that's an excessive amount of money, in my opinion, and for the program. It was really just because it was an easy way to be sustainable. So, I mean, Chef John, you're a cook in the kitchen. You know what it's like to build a week of food, but do it in an easy, practical way. I mean, what they were trying to do was kind of stretch the work, not the dollar.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So they would order in, you know, a giant box of breaded veal cutlets. And, you know, that would be... two dinners that were easy to throw in the oven and you're done.
Right.
So the position itself only held for 4 hours a day. So there's really not a lot you can do with that amount of time.
No,
so it makes
sense.
It's
a bit of a challenge.
Right.
To
right.
Exactly. So that lasted about 2 weeks. And then my hours started going up because they started to see what I was able to actually do. Immediately right off the bat, I implemented a one time a week at least vegetarian day. So, I mean, you got to consider these guys... a lot of them are coming from jail and are used to eating jail food, which...
I'm not familiar with what that looks like.
You know, you could look at it and still not understand what it is. So, you know, it's some sort of vegetable grade protein that's low calorie.
Right.
High calorie, low essential nutrients. So
right.
It's filler pretty much. So it's a little tough to work with that. But... basically, when these guys were coming out, they were not expecting, when they went to treatment, what kind of food they would be eating.
Right.
So anything was good in their eyes. And in my opinion, you know, food is not something that's meant for you or for me or for that person over there. It's meant for everybody. Mm-hmm. And therefore, everybody should be kind of treated to equally with, you know, the same flavors, the same cooking styles, the same kind of deal, whatever.
Yep.
So being... comfortable in the kitchen gave me an opportunity to kind of expand my horizon a little bit with from scratch recipes. So I immediately jumped to vegetarian dishes one time a week and everything as much as I could made from scratch.
Yeah.
So you both are familiar with pasta. I've started making pasta from scratch.
Yeah. Right.
I was making pie crusts from scratch. I was making jams and conserves from scratch. Everything from scratch.
Right. And this is all stuff that they would have previously had just brought in.
Pre-made.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So, but in order to do that, I did have to rely on the donations that the house was getting from some grocery stores or, you know, some past residents and families and stuff that would donate and there'd be an overflow.
Right.
But the stock started to get random and started to get really overflowing of things that are just too small amounts of things for me to actually utilize.
Right.
So the other aspect of my job was cost reduction. Reduce costs. Try to find as much as you can an effective and sustainable way to keep the program running so that they can allocate that money somewhere else, either for another counselor or new beds or, you know, to keep the program
limited
running.
Funds really needed to be stretched further.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing was I partnered up with some of the agencies, the social agencies that were in Nanaimo, that being... specifically the Nanaimo Food Share Loaves and Fishes. And they were and still remain to be the main supplier of food now. And I hope Peter Sinclair doesn't mind too much if I talk about his wonderful program. But basically what he has done and his team is got on board with the grocery stores that are in Nanaimo. Mm-hmm. So I won't label them all, but basically what he does is creates a relationship with them where he came to them and appealed and said, hey, it's going to cost you more money mm-hmm. to recycle and to pick through and to process all of your waste food mm-hmm. that isn't really that bad.
Right.
And get rid of it.
Yeah.
Or you can send it to us and we will process it with our volunteers mm-hmm. and we will reallocate it back out to the homeless and supply resources to other social programs that are trying to help
right.
folks, right?
I think this is amazing. And this is the reason I wanted to talk to you today, because it was like,
yeah.
I'm like, why haven't we been doing this for years? Yeah. You know, like it yeah. makes a yeah. lot of sense to...
Well, and in all fairness, I mean, we'll get back to your story in just a second, but while we're taking a pause, this is sort of, I don't know if it would have been just before this or just after this that you actually contacted us. I was actually in Chicago at a funeral.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And I think John was just gearing into summer, and you had said, here, this is what we're doing down here, and I think you guys might want to get involved, and that's how far back this goes. That's like a year or so ago now.
Yeah, yeah,
and
so...
Yeah, yeah, and we just it just didn't happen, and of course, well, let's finish your story.
Well, yeah. that's okay, honestly. Like that, and when I contacted you at the time, I was just getting things going, and I was like, oh, yeah. this is really great, and
yeah.
I was really excited about it, and I'm obviously still am, but as the year has gone by, it's actually given me a little bit of time to look specifically at how much we've done.
Right.
And now I can sit here today and present that to you guys and be like,
yeah.
like I'm very, very proud of what was able to be accomplished.
Right. Well, let's jump back into that. What was,
yeah.
so what exactly, once you got everything up and running, what was going on?
So what I ended up doing is in the house itself, we have like a micro industrial kitchen. So mm-hmm. everything in there is stainless steel built. We have not a walk-in cooler, but we have a whole bunch of stand-up coolers. We have three big stand-up deep freezers in the back and lots of dry storage. And basically what Loaves and Fishes was able to do was after the food is organized and picked through to see mm-hmm. like take out the bad stuff and find the stuff that's not expired but best before,
right,
that could still be reallocated back out to the food bank and that they started opening up to agencies. So I immediately jumped on board. When I first came in, I think I was one of 10.
Yeah.
And within 1 year, they had skyrocketed to 36 agencies within Nanaimo that were
wow.
that were being supplied by them.
Wow.
And I'm not talking, you know, a couple of cans of soup. I'm talking
yeah.
hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of food every month being thrown in the garbage that this organization, Loaves and Fishes, was able to scoop up, find a warehouse, rescue it, redistribute it back out, and put it to good use.
Wow.
And
that's incredible.
They don't let anything go to waste. So... breads, produce and vegetables that are going to waste, they're giving it to pig farmers. They're mm-hmm. giving it to chicken farmers. And it's
that's
all
Brian.
Being used. Why not, right?
Yeah, that's amazing.
So for myself, I would literally, what my week would look like is twice a week, I would go down and with my own two hands and usually mm-hmm. a client or two, pick through what we would use. And it was awesome because every single time that I went down there, you never knew what you were going to get.
Right.
So you...
It's like the big black box.
Yeah, exactly right. So if you watched any of your reality cooking TV
yeah.
shows, it was like that every week.
Wow.
You never knew, you know, and I was finding out things about food and seeing food that I'd never even seen before.
Right.
And I've never even had a chance to touch or cook one because some of it's beyond my budget. For example,
yeah.
I had 1 week where I took two high-cut premium prime rib roasts that were
yeah.
$98 each.
Right.
And
not the kind of thing that you or I just fool around with in a kitchen.
Yeah. yeah you know, yeah. like that. I make a good salary and a good wage in my job, but I still can't afford a $98 cut of meat.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, not for myself that I would never go
yeah.
buy. So. It was really cool in that respect where I could get meats, an unlimited amount of eggs, milks, juices,
yeah.
tons of canned goods and dry goods, pastas, everything. Basically, I was able to reduce our cost from $4,800 on average a month down to roughly $1,100.
My God. That's
so,
incredible.
And that
offset, of course, by this program.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Wow.
So there was a few other programs that were able to jump in as well, too. Like Quality Foods would hook us up with, you know, $100 voucher every month or something like that. But everything
right.
counted.
Right.
And but these guys specifically were able to supply us with produce, and produce is expensive when you're buying it through a distributor.
Yeah,
right. And or you have to buy big volumes.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So there, I'll tell you a quick funny story. I ordered through Sysco one time a box of bananas, and I got 12 bananas, and it cost me $13.50.
Wow.
For 12 bananas for a small box of them.
Yeah.
So. I was a little surprised, so I actually called up the
and they weren't organic, right?
No.
Yeah.
But basically, I called up the Sysco and I was like, "Look, this is kind of a little bit little bit ridiculous, and I would like to maybe get a credit for this." And they were able to work it out, cuz they're like, "Yeah, this is a little bit expensive. We don't even know why it's this much." So.
Yeah.
But yeah, so neat things like that. I was always getting fresh produce and fresh vegetables. And I mean, they're just as good as quality as that you're getting in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I was able to get very specific niche items that people would just, they wouldn't understand how I was able to get it. I walk in one day to the warehouse and Scott, one of the warehouse managers, he's like, he looks at me and he's like, "Hey, you want some saffron?" And I was like, "Yeah, I do." And he's like, "Come here, come over here." Yeah. And I go, and he's got this box of saffron, and it had to have been about $3,000 worth of saffron.
Wow.
And he just gave me four or five packages, which I look at the superstore, and they're $45 a package.
Right. Yeah. But it's about to be stale dated. It's about to date out, and they can't sell it. Was that the reason?
All kinds of funny things were happening. Yeah. They had a pallet full of spaghetti that were the hollow kind of spaghetti.
Yeah.
And literally what had happened is the guy who ordered it pressed the wrong button on the order, and in came a pallet of 18 boxes, almost $13,000 worth of these pasta.
Oh, yeah.
And too they many. Didn't want them, so they just send them off to Loaves and Fishes.
Wow.
Wow.
So all kinds of stuff like that was happening.
Right.
Some other stuff they were able to help us out with were fresh breads, cakes, desserts, all the kinds of goodies, cookies,
right.
Everything that would help the program. And what that ended up allowing us to do was not only reduce the cost of how much we were spending in the program, I was like, this is a great opportunity. We have 14 programs within the John Howard Society. Why not turn as much as we can over to these other programs as well too and help them out?
Oh, yeah.
So I was using VITC as literally a storage hub. And
right.
we had all the freezer Passing space around. And everything like that. So I would do care packages for clients when they leave the house and they're just going through that first couple of weeks of getting their feet back into society and they're right. on their own now. I'd help them out and give them, a couple of steaks, some eggs and some right. cheese and, the staples and get them going.
Wow, that's incredible.
And then we would do it. We would do it for families. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, the husband ends up reoffending and relapses and ends up back in jail while he's got three kids at home with a, wife who's not taking, taking care of them all and trying to work a
right.
part-time job.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's send them a care package as well too and just get right. them going. Right. Cause she doesn't have the time to go down to the food bank and get it herself.
Yeah. I know that you see the criminal justice system in a completely different light than most of us, and some of those things you don't even consider, right?
No.
But of course, I mean, you definitely need to take care of those people that are impacted by the people that are, going back into the system or what have you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's fantastic.
I think there's just something about being able, and you're teaching people how to cook there too, and showing them.
Yeah, so that
the
became
process.
That
I
became
think
another
that's a huge thing. So
huge.
That became another process, and we took a step back and we're like, okay, well, we have all this food, and I've only got a few hours a day to process everything, so let's do something.
Yeah.
I have pictures at home of 20 guys kneading dough, making pasta, all on a table, and they're throwing eggs at each other, throwing flour around, and they're having a good time, right?
I can imagine this is something they've never done before.
Not at all.
Yeah, right.
Not
wow.
at all. So
have no idea.
No.
Yeah.
So I took a step in a direction towards employment and education. So not only did we try to reduce costs in the house, try to feed these guys better, mm-hmm. and respectfully, very well. They would eat, I think, in my opinion, probably eating better than any other treatment center in Canada.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, well, maybe there's an opportunity to do something as far as training goes. So the executive director always had this idea of saying, wouldn't it be awesome if we could train these guys and get them out working? Mm-hmm. And I had a little bit of a conflicting view on that aspect, mm-hmm. and for two reasons. One, the culinary arts is a fantastic way to make a career, mm-hmm. but in my opinion, you need to be driven for it. It is not something that you take lightly.
Right.
You know, it's learning cooking techniques, I mean...
Yeah, you got to put in your time and you got to care a bit, you know? And
absolutely.
Right? Yeah, you have to care. If the people that don't care, the people that are just there for a paycheck, it shows and they cycle out pretty fast.
Exactly, right. And I know that from being in the industry myself, that if you don't have that flair of creativity, mm-hmm. you're not going to last long and behind the line on a kitchen.
So right.
It becomes laborious work and you don't have that drive to be there anymore.
Yeah.
The other aspect was that I really wanted to teach skills that they could use in their own life. So I combined what Vancouver Island University would have had as their first year culinary arts program and took the structure of the course and then created my own course out of it, which I would teach on a weekly basis. And basically, I was teaching everything from, you know, what the five mother sauces were and mm-hmm. Basic cutting and slicing and dicing techniques, how to hold a knife, how to sharpen a knife.
Right.
You know, proper food safe. 1 hour, I would have a 2-hour block to teach them.
Yeah.
The first hour was always on food safe.
Oh, wow.
The second hour was always on some sort of kitchen culinary technique.
Oh, right on.
And they were going out afterwards and doing a good job sustaining for themselves. I taught them how to look for resources in the community effectively so that they could take everything that we were doing there, go home with it, and know what to do.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know? Well, that's, I mean, and that's, like, that's, I don't know if you had known that, but I know that John knew that, like, that's what I originally wanted to do with Edible Valley. That's what I came into, was I was sitting there as, you know, a newly divorced person that, I mean, I had cooked all my food for my family the entire time I was married, and cooked well for myself before that too. And I was like, I'm in a unique position. I'm a single guy, single dad that knows what he's doing in a kitchen. And I'm like, I'm looking around at all these other single dads or single moms. I'm looking at college students, which is another group, that demographic that I was in deeply entrenched with owning the bar, whether they were employed by me or they were the patrons. Mm-hmm. And just looking at all these people around that have no culinary experience whatsoever, they can't effectively boil a pot of water. And then that's when I came onto the show as a guest for the first time, and John and I were talking, and I was like, I just really wanted, like, my thing, my really, like, the thing that I really want to do in life in food is not achieve any sort of status. I want to teach as many people as I can to not be afraid in the kitchen and to be as comfortable in the kitchen and you know, just show them how easy it is to eat really well. Yeah. And I think that's, like, as soon as you started talking about this program, I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what I would want to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we did one day is I had a whole bunch of full roasting chickens that I was getting from Loaves and Fishes. And I was like, I'm going to hold off on those and not cook those right away. I'm going to use those for a course. So I would teach them meat cutting.
Oh yeah.
And we would break a chicken down and I would say, okay, now go off and come up with as many recipes as you can, and there's a prize at the end or whatever, right?
Right.
And usually throw in a big box of Chips Ahoy cookies or something like that, and they'd all be, you know, good for it. But you know, one guy, he came up, I think, with 9 different dishes that he could do with one roasting chicken for $10.
Wow.
And, like, hats off, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's what we aim for, right? We learn that in different cultures, how to really utilize everything we can.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like right now at home, I have a batch of bone broth going off that, takes 2 days to make, sure, but it's using just bones and carcasses that, you know, we would generally throw away and not know what to do with.
It's the best stuff for a stock, right? Well, like all the scrap ends of everything, throw it. Just have a pot going in the back there and just keep tossing them in there, right? So.
Yeah. So, yeah, teaching them all kinds of stuff. And, you know, successfully I had guys come in and get jobs afterwards. I had guys go to school afterwards. Not all for culinary arts. It was really interesting. 2 of my clients were Red Seal chefs, formed their addiction through the industry.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, I'm not going to
Well, the industry used to be really known for that.
The
well,
industry
it still is.
It still is, right? Like yeah. Drinking and narcotic use is, you know, sometimes it's a way to get through the day.
Right.
It's a way to finish off the day. But it's an area taboo that we don't really address in the industry because we don't really want to.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a deep down people know it and you see it in kitchens and you can tell it. You can tell a kitchen really quickly.
Yeah.
Or at least I can walk into a kitchen and I can be like, okay, I know where the problems are in this kitchen.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it's not something, and it's part of, you know, like people that are drawn to this have a bit of an adrenaline addiction.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, it's when you're online and the orders are coming in and
it's
you're
stress.
Running around, there's stress, there's pressure.
Yeah.
And it's hard on the system.
I know.
It's a mental thing.
I think that's why there's a certain, I wouldn't even call it a camaraderie. I'd say it's an understanding. But once you've been in the industry in a high volume restaurant, even once, and there's a set side of people there that can do that and can't. And I'm not saying that other people couldn't hack it and this is a taunt in any way. I'm just saying there are only a certain group of people that can handle that kind of pressure, the negativity, and still come out on top, rise, you know, and handle that volume, that fast pace, that everything.
Yeah.
And walk out and still want to come back the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can definitely say within there's people that would definitely self-medicate to get through that for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've always encouraged individuals that if they are going to pursue a career in culinary arts and go to an education or academic stream to do that, to talk about it and to not be afraid to talk about it. I mean, the guys that I'm working with all were there for addictions. So that brings me to my second point of why I was a little bit hesitant about doing the whole career and academic endeavor with culinary arts is because I don't want to take an individual who's trying to recover through their addiction, put them in an environment that could potentially be triggering, and then
right.
have them relapse and come right back to me.
Right.
I've seen it myself in the kitchens. You've seen people that are like they've recovered and they've done well, and they're like, I want to get back into it. And the pressure builds, and it's hard too. You know, like at the end of the shift, someone's like, hey, let's buy the kitchen a beer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's one beer, and then it's 20 beer.
Yeah, for sure. Right. In respect of that, I started opening up my teaching profile a little bit to say, okay, well, we're not going to focus just on food industry training. I'll say food and industry training, which was coined by my executive director. I'll make sure he gets the credit for that.
Yeah.
Because we were coming up with acronyms and called it the FIT program, right?
So, right.
Basically, I said, I think it would be good if we didn't just train them for food industry, but gave them the skills that they would use either in industry or not.
Yeah.
So even if I'm training them on culinary art techniques, they're going to go home and teach their family, teach their kids. They're going to be able to cook better for them, all those things. And I feel like that's a win.
Absolutely.
So I started developing a little bit of a, okay, well, what interests you kind of approach, and then started just teaching them all the things that they would need to know. So how to write 3 or 4 different kinds of resumes, how to put references down when you've burned all your bridges from your addiction.
Right.
And really started to expand where we went with that training, but always kept food at the core.
Yeah. Wow.
So it was a very fun.
That's fantastic.
Endeavor.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, when we sitting down and sort of plotting what we were going to do for the next few episodes, and we were talking about having you come in and talk about this, I just sort of wanted to think about, you know, I don't know if John's had any experience. I mean, we didn't talk about this previous to it, but just that, you know, there are programs now developing that are sort of embracing that. I mean, the famous sort of Facebook thing that went through a couple months ago where it's, you know, and the validity, I'm not too sure. I'm sure that it's not as carte blanche as it's made out to be, but it's, you know, France just passed a law saying it's illegal now to discard misshapen or whatever vegetables.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there is validity to that. And I'm sure that it's a little more to it than that. I don't think that it would necessarily be against law. There were probably major fines involved or what have you. Mm-hmm. But just going back to the fact that I grew up in produce, right? My dad was a produce manager my whole life, my whole time growing up in I was in restaurants and he was in produce, and that just sort of one led into the other, that appreciation of food. My mom was an amazing cook. But all these programs didn't really exist. The idea of, like, there was still a big culture of waste back then. And now it just seems, you know, to embrace it a little more. And I don't know what other programs are out there. I know that when I first started the sushi cart, it really pained me when I knew how much waste there was. I knew that in my first event that I wanted to do it differently. So everything I served in was compostable. It wasn't necessarily that you could recycle it. I wanted it to be able to, you can throw it into the compost and it would just, you know, become part of compost. So I had compostables, I had recyclables, and then I had food waste. And that bag of food, every day, the food waste was a full garbage can. And the person who would end up becoming my sister-in-law, Tony, at the time, she lived on a local farm. She was just renting a little farmhouse out from a farm. And she said, you know what? These people have ducks, and I know that they would much rather feed them some better food than what they're getting. You know, maybe I can take this for the ducks. And so that became like the whole summer. I would just take all my food waste and, you know, so long as it didn't have coffee grounds in it, which is one thing that, the, you know, would be lethal to the ducks. Everything else, as long as it was food, it could go to the ducks or go to these ducks.
Yeah.
And from there, I just like, it really opened my eyes. I thought, you know, I used to think there's programs out there, but I don't know what they are and I don't know what they do or how to get in touch with them. And then I realized it really, honestly, it just takes you deciding that you want to do that. All you have to say is, I don't want to throw my food out anymore.
Yeah.
And it can be a compost. It could be, you're donating it to a local farm. I mean, we're lucky. We have hundreds of farms around here. Any one of them would be willing to take any. I'm not talking about social programs. I'm not talking about restaurants. I'm talking about you, you know, that's listening, that, you know, you've got a little compost, but maybe you're not thinking about gardening or whatever. You have no use for your, you know, wilty lettuce core, and you have no, you know, there is use for it out there. There's tons of things that would, you know, would be better fed using that food waste.
Yeah.
But I'm sure, John, maybe you've come across some other sort of food recycling programs or something of that nature. No?
Yeah, well, a little bit, but I think it's something that's just on its infancy.
Yeah.
Like, I think like the program that you're talking about there, I mean, those are just new programs, right? Like, this is something that's just getting going. I mean, even in my own kitchen there, we had this one girl, Jen, she's had pig farm. She's got all this. Anyways, we've been throwing out a lot of compost because we can't compost anywhere.
Right.
You know, it's getting it out. And all of a sudden someone said, what do your pigs eat?
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, they eat all this stuff. I'm like, yeah. So why not? She's like, I'm like,
I've noticed.
If I fill these bins, will you take them every day? Promise, they have to go every day. So now they start collecting all that. So
I noticed that actually.
We're feeding three pigs now. So it's like
at the end. Yeah, at the end of the that prep counter and right around from there, there's that new sort of bin that's just for the pigs, and I think that's awesome.
It's a little bit of teaching my staff too that there's only certain things that go in there because pigs don't eat onions.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Or at least
and that's just it. Is that I mean. Not everything works just, it's not always 100% just, you know, the sort of the fast food kind of culture of everything has to be go, 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 quick, 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 easy, easy, easy. To properly, you know, nurture these animals, if that's how you decide that you want to do it, you definitely need to know what they will and won't eat. And then it's easy to just separate that. Like, it's not a difficult task. But I'm happy to see that it's happening. Like, I love it. I think that it's fantastic. And watching my dad, who literally would get himself to the point of tears sometimes when he was throwing away cases of produce. I remember being there and him throwing away cases of produce. And he's just like, this is just wrong. It's just wrong. It just shouldn't be happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, and there's so many things you can do with it, right? Like, I mean, peppers that are, say, half rotten on one side, cut them off. Give them a wash. Throw them into a salsa or throw them into a sauce.
Absolutely.
So like that kind of stuff. So, excuse me, in respect to what I was talking about, that's very on the grand macro scale of, you know, corporation and infrastructure.
Yeah.
So in that regard, we're looking at what grocery stores are throwing away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to hit on what you were saying about what we're throwing away every single day.
Yeah.
There's so many things that we can be doing to really reduce how much we're turfing. I mean, a couple examples that my partner and I do at home is we have Fridge Sunday.
Right.
So on Fridge Sunday, we don't go buy groceries.
Yeah.
We go and we eat whatever's in the fridge and that is it.
Really?
You know? So it takes you away from that breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Oh, I have to have those three meals of the day.
Right.
And you just snack on whatever's in the fridge all day, eat your leftovers, eat whatever.
Right.
Two, recycle your bones.
Yeah.
Do whatever you can to recycle your bones.
That's the biggest thing.
Number
Never
three,
let them go to waste.
Number three, learn how to cook something new once a week.
Yeah.
I mean, if you put that into your practice and say, once a week, I'm going to learn how to cook a new recipe. I'm going to learn how to make something from scratch. I don't care what it is. Mm-hmm. You're going to start seeing your budget not be going towards food so much because you're going to be learning how to do everything from scratch. You'll be like, oh, why do I need to buy a pizza when I have all of the ingredients in the fridge?
Right. Yeah.
Why do I need to go and make pasta when I've got eggs and flour?
And you know what? It's a great family event.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Like if anything, like forget sitting down around the tube.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. let's make, we do this at my house all the time. We had taco night the other day and my daughter was up there chopping away tomatoes and all this great stuff. Yeah. And it was just amazing. And she was energized about cooking.
Absolutely.
Like, she wanted to be in there, which was
just today. Yeah. Same thing. I had a couple things that I was going to do, just to prep up. And Ben actually said, what can I do? Which one's for me? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. You can have any one of those tasks. They're all within your realm of ability. So you can do whichever one you want. Yeah, he chose to make the salad dressing. So, but I think that, and I'm completely losing what I was saying there. I was thinking of, whatever. It'll come back to me, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are a few examples of things you can be doing in your own home.
Yeah.
Another thing that you can be doing is anytime you make something that you eat on a regular basis, make a lot of it and freeze it or preserve it, learn how to do those things. Because as you mentioned, a lot of people have this aversion to cooking because, you know, especially if they're friends with a cook.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, I don't need to cook. I'll just invite Brian over.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of deal. He can cook for me.
Yeah.
You know, someday I'm going to have someone say, Brian, I really want to cook for you and I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry and I won't have to pay for it or nothing. Just come on over and I'm going to cook for you. I'm waiting for that day.
Do you know, and not to get all into personal stuff, but I went out on a date the other night and I said to her.
It's pretty personal.
Yeah, well.
Where are we going now?
We got into food and we were talking about food and she just said, oh, I'm looking forward to you cooking me a meal. And I was like, and I didn't even talk about this at the time, but I have never had anyone, a woman other than my mother, cook me food at all. Like I'm 40 years old and I've never had a date, a wife, anything, anybody. Cause they were also, they're like, oh, you got it covered. You're the cook. Like you're the guy. Right. And I'm like, no, one of these days I'd love to have somebody cook for me.
I know, you know,
I'd
like,
love it.
So is there anyone out there, any of our listeners that are looking for a date with Darren? He would like, what's your favorite meal?
But one thing I did want to get back to, that one part that I'd forgotten, a really easy thing to do, again, just as much as recycling your bones, how much that's going to change your kitchen. I truly believe that. Like as soon as you get into using the bones, everything changes. Same with if you're not composting, don't throw away your veggies. And like as they're going bad, I chop them and freeze them, throw them in the freezer. I have ongoing freezer bags that I keep adding to, and they become my stocks. And then now that I always have stocks that I can cook off once I have a full bag of veg. And that's my onion ends, my scrubbed but peeled carrot peels. That's my, you know, my celery ends that aren't, they don't look good to chew on, but they're fine. You know,
another thing people forget, that's where the best nutrition is.
Yeah.
The skin is where all the vitamins are.
Absolutely. And if you really, really, really want to push the boundaries of it, you always keep your bone and vegetable matter after you've already cooked the stock for 2 days, you know, and freeze it. And then you can make a half stock or you can add it to your next stock and you've got all that flavor, right? Like nothing goes to waste.
Exactly. And that's just it. And I don't think that people realize that once you've got your own steady supply of stocks, just again, how much easier you've got one of the most important building blocks to stepping away from basic cooking into what they would say is like culinary or dining or what have you. I mean, that's when you've got your basis for soups, you got your basis for sauces, gravies.
Never mind the profound criteria of health benefits that you're going to get out of it from, you know, the calcium, the collagen, the everything out there, right?
So. Absolutely. And that, and you know, yeah, I mean, again, we've talked about how to sort of touch on those basics and I'd love to do some more there as Edible Valley, I'd love to do more there to figure out a way to educate everybody, you know, just even just some of those core basics. So we'll see how everything develops over time. But yeah, I love sitting down and talking about this stuff. Of course, you can see I don't want to shut up about it.
No, it's all good. It's a great way to live. Once you can start getting your head wrapped around food waste and how much convenient eating is actually causing more stress to your life than non-convenient eating, which what we would call that. But basically, it's just you have to do a little bit of work.
Yeah.
It's going to change your life. It'll change the way you interact with your friends and family. It's food at the heart of it all is a very, very powerful thing. And I think I remember writing a paper in my sociology class in my first year or something about the differences between Western culture eating and Eastern culture eating, because I'm half Vietnamese.
Right.
And, you know, a few examples is, here we cut and stab our food, where in Asia, a lot of places, the food is already cut up and you eat it delicately with chopsticks.
Right.
You know, so we think about, you know, we don't think about these things in that kind of respect, but once you can learn different cultures of food, you're going to change how you even interact.
Right.
With each other and enjoy food in a different level, right?
So. Yeah.
I always believe in food as a thing of sharing.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
absolutely.
It's sharing a part of you. Mm-hmm. It's a part of who you are, what you are.
Yeah.
And just being able to enjoy that with someone else. I mean, that's the best part of food. That's why I've never been big on competitions. So.
Yeah. That's actually something that even though I didn't even understand it really, but when I was married, my wife, she did point out we were just discussing something one time and she's like, I know that your favorite way to show that you love someone is to feed them. Mm-hmm. Like I can see that in you. And I was just like, whoa, I didn't even notice that. But she's like, no, you do. Anybody that's close to you, you always want to feed them. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it's true. I guess I do. But yeah. And I agree. Like I do that. And I want to pass that on to my kids. I don't, you know, I think that that's a great trait that I didn't even notice that I had.
Yeah.
And I just sort of embrace that. So
yeah.
Well, thank you, Brian. I think we're definitely going to have to come back in here again and have another chat with us.
For sure.
I'd love you to come back to have a group discussion with us about on food waste, because I think that'd be a great little panel to have a few different people from different regions just to talk about what they can do with food waste and how we can improve the whole system of food right now. So
I'd love to.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, great.
All right. Well, I guess we'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in again and listening to the Edible Valley podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe and follow us at theediblevalley.com. Check out our Facebook site, Twitter, and wherever else we are.
We're kind of all over social media.
We're trying
right
to get
now.
As many places as possible.
And thanks to our sponsors. Right now, we are being sponsored by Atlas and Ivan's Truffles. And we'd love to add another key one or two people to that sponsors list. So please get in touch with us if you're interested.
Yeah, and don't forget to send your thoughts and questions to theediblevalley@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks for coming in with us, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
The Atlas Cafe, celebrating 20 years in the Comox Valley. Globally inspired, locally sourced.
Do you like chocolate?
I like chocolate.
IvansTruffles.com.